Hedy Epstein, Reel 3.
To continue on Gertrude, I felt later that day, I felt literally like a load has been lifted from my shoulders, that I wasn't aware I'd been carrying around with me all these years. Because now I've been able to tell her how I felt about what she had done to me at the time that we were classmates. But since then, I have some real concerns about, is she now carrying this load that I used to carry? Have I shifted it onto her shoulders? And I've been going back and forth whether or not I should write to her, because at the end of that particular talk, as well as other talks when I spoke about my Holocaust-related experience, I would always say that I have not come to accuse, I've come in friendship and in reconciliation. And did I accuse her when I said to her that she was my persecutor, or was that a statement of fact? Am I rationalizing when I say it was a statement of fact? I made no effort at friendship and reconciliation. Am I being hypocritical when I said this at other times? I've discussed it with a number of people, and yes, I was told Gertrude made no effort at reconciliation, but I don't have to wait for somebody to reach out to me. I can be the first one to do it, and I didn't do it. And so I still haven't decided. But probably will before the year is over, and it's almost over. And maybe as a year-end gesture, write a note to her about what I've been thinking and feeling since our encounter. I don't think I can offer her friendship, but I want her to know that I've not just sloughed it off and maybe shifted the burden onto her shoulders. Just, you know, maybe give her an opportunity to think about it, and not in when I accuse her, but when I make some attempt at reaching out to her, even though it's not in friendship and it's not really in reconciliation. But it's some attempt at that, saying that, you know, okay, you know, I can go on from here, and I hold no more grudges against you, because I've had an opportunity to tell you how I feel or how I felt at that time. And let's go on from here. Yeah, I wish you well.
Yes, it seems that this has presented you with perhaps the biggest challenge that you've yet had, would you?
Yes, I've never had been challenged like this. I've never had to confront somebody who really personally did something to me. And it did something to me in a hurtful way. And this was the first opportunity, and did I botch it? You know, because I say I'm coming in friendship and reconciliation. Certainly made no attempt. I now wish, but I can't undo this now, wish that I had made time, and I could have made time for maybe the two of us to sit down. I don't really think she would have changed her story, because her memory of that time are good memories. It was a good time. You know, it was a time when she was in the Hitler Youth and they had these wonderful outings. They went on hikes, and they sat around campfires, and they sang songs, and they told stories about their political indoctrination, which I'm sure was maybe subtle at other times, maybe not so subtle. But she was still a young girl at the time. She was only 14 at the time, or younger, or earlier than that. And so her memories are good memories. Mine are a whole different experience and are very different than hers. And maybe she can't relate to because the birth, it was a wonderful time. The interesting thing about this whole exchange is also my body language at that time. And since some photographs were taken at the time, I can even document it with photographs. But I remember when she was standing in front of, standing next to me in front of all the students, all of a sudden I became aware that I'm standing there with my hands in my pockets. And I realized what that meant, and I very consciously said to myself silently, "And you're going to keep your hands in your pockets." And because and her hands are sort of extended to me, so she's trying to reach out to me, and I'm pulling back. And I think that was in many ways how I felt probably in 1938 and earlier than that, when she was reaching out to me in a very destructive way, in a very ugly way, and I was pulling back and holding on to myself. And here I am holding on to myself again in 1997 when she's reaching out to me, but reaching out to me in a, not in an aggressive, negative way. She's very aggressive again, but not in a destructive way. She wants to be friends this time, or wants to remember that we were friends. But I'm holding back and protecting myself by having my hands in my pockets and holding on to myself. Don't get too close to me, because that's how I felt in 1938. I was afraid of her. And here I am, not afraid of her, but I'm still, my body language is the same.
If I could ask you, Hedy, you know, it's very interesting because I know you speak to children and people in America. Did you find any difference in the sort of issues that Germans were interested in compared with Americans?
Yeah, it's very two questions that I find very interesting to who's asking them. For instance, in the United States, I am always, I don't think it's ever happened when I've not been asked that question about the other Jewish child in the school who was also thrown out in November 1938, students as well as adults will ask me, what happened to this other Jewish child? In Germany, I was only asked that question twice. In Germany, I was, each and every time that I spoke about my Holocaust-related experience, I was asked about my life in England. What was it like? In the United States, I very, very seldom asked what life was like in did I say the United States? I meant in England. And in the United States, I've been asked very seldom what my life was like in England after I left Germany. And I've tried to analyze this, and I'm not sure if my analysis is correct, but here it is. I think in Germany, they wanted to know that life was better for me when I left, and they were hoping that I would say, life in England was wonderful. In the United States, it's assumed that life was wonderful. In Germany, they don't want to know another horror story. That maybe I've heard to say that something awful happened to this other student, and they don't want to know another horror story. In the United States, they want to know another horror story, so that hopefully I could say something bad, really bad happened to him, which it did. But I'm not sure if this analysis is correct. But it's just interesting. And I have, since I've come back to the United States, I've given a number of talks, and I've asked people, why are you asking this question? I haven't gotten any answer to that. I just want to know that's sort of the answer that I've gotten. But I will continue to ask, and maybe I can find half of the answer. I can't ask it in Germany anymore because I'm not there.
Did you get any feeling in Germany? This is very sort of general of all the areas you were in, and really two parts to the question: whether there was any understanding of what you were talking about, and the genuine interest.
There had to be genuine interest because I reached somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 people. And so there had to be some kind of interest, whatever that interest may have been. But I was particularly aware of the responses and the reactions of the young people who were saying, we need to know this because there's been too much silence. Our parents or our grandparents won't talk about it when we ask questions. And we need to know. You know, it's like we learn the German history, and then, now it's being taught what happened during the Holocaust. But for instance, people in their 20s and 30s have said to me that we learned the German history up to 1933 in great detail, and then Hitler came to power and the war broke out in 1939, and it was over in 1945, and then we go into detail about what happened afterwards. And we weren't taught what happened during that period. And when we asked questions, there were no answers to that. But the young people now, you know, the grade school, middle school, high school students, they are learning about this in school, and they know about it. And whenever there's an opportunity, at least in the schools where I spoke, other survivors have been invited to talk, and they use every opportunity to invite survivors, so that they not only have the book knowledge, but have the experience of meeting somebody who lived through some of this.
So, you know, it certainly seems that the young people, you know, did not have the sort of knowledge about it, and you know, this is why they were so interested. But did you find any understanding at all from older people?
Well, you know, like I spoke at some length, for instance, with my former classmates from the grade school, and I heard again and again and again that either we didn't know, or there was nothing that we could do, or one of them said to me, and she comes from maybe a strong Catholic background, that her mother said to her that if the war had continued any longer, or very much longer, we would have been the next ones to have been sent to a concentration camp. I asked her why her mother felt this way, and she said, well, because we were Catholic, and because we didn't go along with the Nazi ideology. And I said, but then wouldn't something have happened earlier? And she said, no, it was just, you know, it hadn't yet been our turn. Now, I don't know if that's rationalization from her part. I don't really know what happened at that time. To her and her family in particular. But it was, you know, like we lived our lives and we knew that certain things were going on, but we were helpless to do anything. Like another one said to me that she remembers her mother came home from visiting the cemetery at the time of Kristallnacht, and that she came home and she said she heard glass shattering, and she thought when she came home, she said, I think they broke the windows in the synagogue. And but that was a statement, and that was that. And there was you know, and when I think back of, you know, what could this woman have done? You know, there was probably nothing that she could have done. One thing that I didn't mention and I need to mention is I received 5 slides which were taken secretly at the time of the deportation on October 22, 1940. There was a man who either was in the village by accident, or maybe he knew that something was about to happen, and he purposely was there. I don't really know that. But he was there with his bicycle. And in the carrier on his bicycle, he had a shoebox. And in the shoebox, he had his camera. And it was not permitted to take photographs of the actual deportation of the Jews, but he took at least 5 photographs, because I have received slides of these 5 photographs that he took, which shows how the people, the Jewish people, were being put onto trucks, which were guarded by German army people. And on one photograph, someone explained to me that one of the men standing next to a truck, based on some insignia that he has on his left sleeve, that was an SS man. One man, for instance, he's carrying 2 suitcases. On another one, you see an older woman trying to climb onto the truck. The SS man and the German army soldier are standing there and not helping her. It's obviously very difficult for her. And someone who's already on the truck is reaching out to her, and she seems to be grabbing hold of this person's hand. On one photograph, exactly who that is, because I know I recognize the house, and there was only one house like that in the village, and I knew the family that lived there. And one of the people coming out of the gate from the yard and next to the house is a then 10-year-old boy, and he is one of the survivors. He now works in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. And this photograph was sent to him, and he identified himself and his parents. He's being followed by his father. His grandmother is ahead of him. And the interesting thing is, on each of these photographs, in the background, you see people watching. Some of them are children. Many of them are adults looking out of the window or standing on the street and watching. You can see a farmer with his cow. I don't know who these people are that are watching, but these people certainly cannot be the ones that could ever say, "I didn't see anything, I didn't know anything." It was not a normal thing for people to be taken out of their homes, carrying a suitcase and going on a truck, and then never being seen again. That just isn't a normal event.
Have you had time, Hedy, I know you came back well under a month ago, really, to sort of look at this rather sort of in a detached way and try to work out how important that your talks were. Do you think they had an impact on the people you spoke to?
I'd like to think that they had an impact. And judging from the feedback that I got from one-on-one from people, as well as the newspaper coverage and the comments that maybe other people made to a newspaper reporter, I think it was very important that I was there. It was important that I said what I said. it was particularly important to understand it in the village where I come from. It was also important to say it in places where, you know, far removed from the village where I come from, because similar things happened there. And just judging by the large numbers of people that came, and, you know, or the schools that where the students had no choice, I mean, they had to come, but that the teachers or the principals felt it was important that these students hear this, and that the faculty of this hear too. I think I've come away that I've accomplished a part of my mission of sharing my experience and asking them to think about what I've told them and to remember it and to share that with other people also, so that it goes beyond those that I immediately directly talk to.
How about the effects on you? I mean, looking at you and knowing you, you're like an energetic teenager. But I know that, you know, after all, you were a victim of a teenager, weren't you? A young teenager,
yes.
At the time of the persecution. So, you know, was this a strain for you, Hedy?
No, that's the amazing thing, and it was almost amazing to me. I know I'm a very energetic person, but my days started early in the morning. The latest, I think, that I ever got up was at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was maybe once or twice. But usually I had to be up at 7 in the morning, and sometimes even earlier. And I wouldn't get back. My day wasn't over until 1, 1:30, and sometimes even as late as 2. And I think I was energized by the audience, by the receptivity of the audience and the openness of people, and how they made me feel, how welcome they made me feel, and their expression of thanks that I was there, not only in words, and the words meant more to me than all the other things, but I would get flowers and candy and bottles of wine and books. I was literally overwhelmed, but I all the flowers I gave to Mr. Christ's wife, and their home looked almost like a funeral kind of flower because there were flowers everywhere. She was running out of containers to put the flowers in. People kept on saying to me, "Aren't you tired? Aren't you exhausted?" And I said, "No, I'm not." I mean, when I got back finally to where I was staying, I fall into bed and go into a deep sleep. But the next morning, I was up and at it again. And I never felt exhaustion, and I didn't feel exhaustion after I came back either. I thought now it's going to catch up with me, and it hasn't.
Well, Hedy, thank you very much indeed for telling me, or telling the museum, you know, yet another episode of your sort of post-Holocaust experience. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for taking the time and your interest and the museum's interest. And I wish you and the museum well in all your endeavors.
Thank you very much, Hedy. Thank you.